Podcast Time.
I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to the first in a brand new series of The First Time. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. And we start this series with a genuine music legend, someone whose work and influence extends far beyond the genre he first found fame in. He's a supremely gifted pianist and keyboard player, as well as being a composer and a band leader. Over a seven-decade career, he played with jazz royalty like Donald Byrd and Miles Davis, both of whom sought out his inventive, technically and emotionally brilliant playing. Pioneering records like 1966 Maiden Voyage, 1970's Fat Albert Rotunda, and the classic 73 album Headhunters saw him absorbing funk and soul and electronics. In fact, he's constantly shifted and challenged himself, and his music, some of which was seen as being too divergent at the time, is now revered by artists like Kamasi Washington, Kendrick Lamar, Thundercat and Robert Glasper. My guest on The First Time this week is, I'm proud to say, Herbie Hancock. You just heard Fat Mama from Fat Albert Rotunda. And over the next hour, you're going to hear how a prodigiously talented 11-year-old Herbie got an early taste of success, some of the lessons he learnt playing with Miles Davis, and how his groundbreaking 80s hit Rocket had a huge impact on the breakdancing scene. We'll also discover how Herbie's philosophy of hope and belief, both in music and his wider life, have kept him, even at 82, still pushing forward and innovating, while also maintaining humility and more than a little humour. But I started by asking Herbie, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
My parents listened to jazz. My father had a good singing, really good singing voice. And so they would listen to opera a little bit, some R&B. Rhythm and blues back in that time was played in the household. That was pretty much it.
What kind of thing do any artists spring to mind?
I know they listened to Duke Ellington, Count Basie, you know, some of the big bands like that. Ella Fitzgerald. Fats Waller was actually my mother's favorite musician.
Right.
Be sure it's true when you say I love you. It's a sin to tell alive. Billions of hearts have been broken, yes, yes. Just because these words were spoken. You know the words that were spoken? Here it is. I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. Yes, but if you break my heart, I'll break your jaw and then I'll die. So be sure it's true when you say I love you. It's a sin to tell a lie. Now get on out there and tell your lie. What is it?
I think my father was more interested in the singers. You know. He sang in the choir in church.
Yeah, yeah.
He wasn't primarily a soloist, but every once in a while he'd get some kind of solo thing in church. I was actually more interested in science.
Yeah.
Now, what I will tell you is that my best friend, his name was Lavester Corley, and he lived in the same apartment building. So he and I would hang out a lot, but and his parents had a little more money than my parents did. So he lived in a bigger, better apartment. And I found myself going to his place more than him coming to mine. He was a year older than me. And on his 7th birthday, his parents bought him a piano.
Okay.
And what I remember is going up to his apartment more often than I had been before. And I would ask him if I could go play the piano. Now, I didn't know how to play piano, so I don't know what I did. And maybe he taught me the song Chopsticks. I'm sure he did. So I have no idea what else I was doing on that instrument, but I liked it. Well, my mother noticed I seemed to be interested in the piano, which made her happy because she wanted her children to have culture, right? And so on my 7th birthday, my parents bought me a piano. That was my birthday present from them. Actually, it took me years to realize that was really a piano for the family. So that was 1947.
Because you were like, obviously, a child prodigy. You had this incredible talent. I was kind of wondering, because the adults are obviously aware, wow, what they're doing is kind of, this is special. But are the kids aware, or are you just doing your thing?
Because, you know, I'm a lot older now. I've heard that word prodigy thrown around a lot. It just goes right over my head. I never even paid attention to that. You know, you have your good days and your bad days. And that was a good day when I played for the audition for this young people's series contest on piano. And I won when I was 11. It was a B flat concerto that I played for the audition. And later on, my music teacher, who happened to be sitting in the back of the hall where I had auditioned, which was Orchestra Hall in Chicago. It's a place where the symphony normally plays. It's the home of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah.
Anyway, she said there were two other teachers that were back in the hall, and the hall was basically empty for this contest. And she told me later that they were in tears listening. So I must have touched them some kind of way. Anyway, I won that contest, and the prize was to play that concerto with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Well, a few months later, maybe it took, I don't know, 3 or 4 months for them to send me a notification. It said, congratulations, yada, yada, yada. It said, unfortunately, we can't find the orchestral parts for the concerto that you played. So you'll either have to learn a new concerto or forfeit and not perform. Well, I wasn't about to forfeit, so I had to learn a new concerto, which I didn't know as well as the one in B flat. So I played the D major concerto. I think it was called the subtitle, the Coronation Concerto. So I performed it on that day. You know, I was wearing short pants and long socks. It was funny that actually in orchestra hall, when the orchestra performs first and there's no piano on the stage, right? So when it was time for me to perform, they wheeled the 9-foot concert grand onto the stage. And then this little kid in short pants walks out onto the stage through the violin section. And then I played the concerto. And then I didn't know it as well as the B flat, but I got through it, you know, and I actually signed my first autographs on that day. You know, I remember there was a little girl that was around my age asking me for my autograph. Wow, I got to sign some autographs today. The big deal, right? My music teacher had a surprise for me that she had bought tickets to another concert by another pianist that was to perform a week after my performance. Classical pianist named Myra Hess, who I think is from the UK. Anyway, she was, you know, one of the top pianists at that time. So we go there to Orchestra Hall again a week later, and Myra Hess plays the B-flat concerto with the orchestra, with the parts. And my music teacher was livid about that. And she said, "Now, how could they do that to a little kid?" And she was sure that if I were a white kid, that wouldn't have happened.
Right.
So it was clear to her that it was, that was racism, you know. They wanted me to forfeit because I didn't have much time to learn a new concerto. You know, it's debatable whether it was, you know, racism or not. But as far as I know, I was the first black kid to actually win that contest. That was 1947.
That first record you did, that first, that Taken Off album, because it's such a beautiful record, an amazing statement. Do you think you were pretty ambitious? Do you think you had, like, goals in sight? Because it's a very realized piece, that. It's got an assurance to it straight out the traps, you know?
You give me too much credit. I was a 22-year-old kid, and it was Donald Byrd, great jazz trumpet player, who actually discovered me and hired me, you know, to be a permanent member of his. He and Pepper Adams, who was a fabulous baritone saxophonist. I had to move to New York, and Donald really took me under his wing. And one day he said to me, "Okay, Herbie, it's time for you to make your own record." And he had a contract with Blue Note Records. And I said, "What do you mean, Donald? I'm not ready. I'm not ready to make a record yet."
No. Really? You said that?
Yeah. He said, "Yes, you are." And I'm thinking, "Oh, no." And he said, "Well, the difficulty is Blue Note Records really had a lot of amazing young artists on their label anyway. They had Freddie Hubbard on trumpet. They had Wayne Shorter, saxophone, and many, many others. They loved the people that they had on there. And these were like trendsetters. But if you're unknown and... you know, don't have some reputation already built up, they're reluctant to let you do a record, right? So that was the trick. They loved having young people on their label, but to get on their label as a young person is hard to do. So Donald said, "I have an idea. Why don't we tell them that you've gotten drafted?" Because we used to still have that at that time. "That you've gotten drafted into the Army and that you wanted to make a record before you go." And I said, "Okay."
Clever.
So it worked. They said they would let me do the record. Actually, I didn't talk to them, but Donald Byrd did. But he told me, he said, "Here's how it works. Half the record is for you. Half the record is for the record label." And I said, "What does that mean?" He said, "Well, the half the record can be your compositions," because he knew that I was writing songs. And he said, "The other half has to be like a blues or one of the standards, you know, great American standards, and maybe what they call a rhythm tune, rhythm chord changes. It's the same chord changes from George Gershwin's I Got Rhythm," because that was a staple in the jazz community. And I said, "Wait, how does that work?" He said, "Well, people buy records that have something on them that they're familiar with. They're familiar with the blues. They're familiar with, you know, the great American songbook, you know, the old standards and the..." But then the other part of the record can be your compositions. But people aren't going to buy the record for your compositions because they don't know those songs, right?
Yeah, sure.
So I said, okay. So I decided, okay, one of the things I wanted to do was to write something that I felt was really from my foundation, from, you know, out of the Chicago influence. You know, Chicago's a blues town. You know, blues really came from the African-American history, really. So I started thinking, okay, what's the most ethnic character I could think of? And it was the Watermelon Man. And I remember he would go through the alley with, and they had a horse-drawn wagon at that time. They had not converted to trucks. Anyway, I wrote the melody based off of the women yelling, "Hey, Watermelon Man," from their balconies and back porch. And then I thought about maybe somehow capturing the sound and image of the wagon wheels going over the cobblestone alleys. That's how I constructed the song. Couple of other things that I wrote, and I had to play them for the label, just kind of a skeleton version, to let them know what I was recording. And Donald said, "They're going to insist that you put the songs on their publishing company." He said, "Don't let them put it in their publishing company." He said, "I will set up, you know, help you set up your own publishing company so you have them in there." And anyway, I had to go the next day to see them. So, and sure enough, they said, "You know, yeah, we record your songs, but you'll have to put your songs in our publishing company." And I said, "No, I can't." They said, "Why not?" I said, "I can't." They said, "Why can't you?" I said, "Because they're in my publishing company already," which was a lie. And anyway, they said, "Well, I guess we can't record you." I got up and I started walking toward the door slowly. And just as I was about to put my hand on the doorknob, they said, "Okay, wait, okay, hold on. Come on back. They said, "Okay, you can keep your own publishing," which I'm so happy they did that.
Earlier, when I was going through some of your stuff, I was watching some footage of the Miles Davis Quintet in Germany in 1967. I mean, obviously, like, you sound amazing. There's that thing where there's a unity to the group, but it's all the very distinct personalities at the same time. But you look great. My God, you look good. There was some very good tailoring there, man. Obviously, musically, but, like, there was a real power to your presence, the music and the look, the whole thing. Is there a moment with your time with Miles that you're kind of most proud of, that you're kind of like, that's where it really, for me, really, really all went as good as it could possibly have been?
Well, I mean, first of all, I never even I had dreamed of playing with other bands, you know, maybe with Art Blakey's band, because that was a very popular band, and other bands. I never dreamed of ever playing with Miles Davis. That was beyond anybody's dream, right? And Miles was only in his 30s. He wasn't quite 40 years old yet. I think he was 37 or 38 when I joined his band. I mean, he had been recording since the 40s. So I assumed he was like in his 50s, you know, which is old. But a particular time that was special for me, I mean, there were a lot of special times for different reasons, but I remember one concert that we played where everybody was on. It was, I think we were playing in Sweden, big concert hall, almost like an arena, and it was packed. And it was, you know, part of a big European tour that we were doing, and everybody was firing away. And we really had the audience locked in the palm of our hands.
How does that feel when it's... when it's like that?
Oh, it's just feel like you're in heaven or something. it's almost unbelievable where everything is connecting and everything is, I mean, there are many surprises that certain things happen at the same time, you know, but by accident, you know, just things moving in so much the same direction. The band was really tight. It almost felt like many, many people with one mind. That's something we use in Buddhism too. There'll be many people with one mind, which is to elevate everybody's life condition, elevate your own and help everybody else to elevate their life condition. So this was that kind of unity until, right, in a peak moment of the concert, when Miles was playing his solo, and his solo was building, and everything was, it was really tight. And then at the apex of this solo, bam, hit this chord. That was a chord, and it was completely wrong, right? And I just felt like I destroyed the whole evening. You know, I just broke everything. You know, everything fell like a house of cards. I wanted to crawl under the floor, right? And Miles, he didn't turn around and nothing. He just took a breath, and he played some notes that made my chord right. And I could not figure out how he did that. And we continued and played the rest of the concert. Anyway, it took me years to figure out what actually happened. Finally occurred to me that Miles did something that I didn't do, or he didn't do something that I did. I judged what I played, and Miles didn't judge it. You know, just like in the morning, we get up in the morning, we don't know whether the phone's going to ring or whether the doorbell's going to ring or whether it's going to be raining or anything. We human beings live life moment to moment like playing jazz. So whatever happens moment to moment, we try to make it work. When we judge the fact that it's raining, I was like, I'm going to get wet and all that. Okay, that's an individual interpretation. Kids will look out and see that it's raining, and they're happy. They can put their boots on. They can go and play out in the rain and, you know, splash the water. So it depends on your perception. Miles didn't judge what I played. He heard it as something new that happened. And as a musician in a band, he did what we all try to do, is to make it work, no matter what anybody plays. Human beings are like jazz musicians. Day to day, always improvising.
That was If I Were a Bell from the Miles Davis Quintet album Live at the Plugged Nickel, recorded at the Chicago nightclub of the same name in 1965. We'll have a bit more Miles Davis in the next half hour and also a deep dive into Herbie Hancock's landmark album Headhunters. But first, let's go to the Six Music News.
Six Music. BBC Radio, Six Music.
And we're the BBC News at 1:30. I'm Jason Kay. The government's insisting it's for rail bosses and unions to solve a dispute expected to cause widespread disruption to services this week. Around 40,000 members of the RMT union are walking out over pay, conditions and job cuts. The Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, said the government had done its bit by investing £16 billion in the railways during the pandemic. But the Shadow Levelling Up Secretary, Lisa Nandy, believes workers are making reasonable demands.
They're not clamouring for strike action. They're asking for safety and security on the railways. They're asking not to be replaced with agency staff. They're asking not to lose their jobs. And they're asking for a government that takes seriously the request for a pay settlement at a time when inflation is soaring and every single working person, every business in this country is struggling.
The new head of the British Army has sent a rallying cry to his troops to be ready to confront the renewed threat posed by Russia. In a letter, General Sir Patrick Sanders said the invasion of Ukraine underlined the Army's core purpose to protect the UK and be ready to fight and win wars. Here's our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale.
General Sir Patrick Sanders sets out his priorities for the Army, and he clearly identifies the greatest current threat, Russia. He says the world has changed since its invasion of Ukraine. There is now, he says, a burning imperative to forge an army capable of fighting alongside our allies and defeating Russia in battle. He sets out his goal as the new chief of the General Staff to accelerate the mobilisation and modernisation of the army to reinforce NATO and deny Russia the chance to occupy any more of Europe.
Germany is putting emergency measures in place in case Russia reduces or stops gas deliveries. It's proposing to make more than £12 billion available to fill storage facilities ahead of next winter. The Irish Premier Michael Martin has said that UK government plans to scrap some of the post-Brexit trading arrangements in Northern Ireland represent economic vandalism. Mr. Martin described the decision to bring in legislation to change the Northern Ireland Protocol as unacceptable, but he added there might be a landing zone for negotiations around the operation of the agreement.
If we have a complete unilateral reneging on an international agreement that the United Kingdom government itself signed up to, then of course we're in a very serious situation. But we want to avoid that. Nobody wants a trade war. We want this resolved. We believe it can be resolved with goodwill.
The Irish Prime Minister, Micheál Martin. Now, Manchester United's chief executive, Richard Arnold, has admitted to a group of angry fans that the club had burned through £1 billion on players in recent years and that hadn't done well with the money spent. He met the supporters who'd been planning to protest outside his house in a pub, and he was recorded as saying that last season at Old Trafford had been a nightmare. Well, that's the Six Music news for now. The next update for you here on Six Music is going to be at 2:30.
BBC Radio. Six Music.
I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time here on Six Music. And my guest this week is pianist, keyboard player, composer, innovator, producer, musical hero, and all-round legend, Herbie Hancock. And you just heard Chameleon, a track that signalled a huge stylistic jump from the Miles Davis Quintet, from the jazz standards and avant-garde experimentation that Herbie had immersed himself in throughout the 60s. So let's jump back into the conversation as I asked him about the seminal record from 1973, where everything changed. Headhunters has kind of become like It's like part of the source, you know, for there's a whole generation of guys like Kamasi Washington and all these people are like, for them, that's like, it's kind of like a Bible, you know? And at the time, it was obviously pushing in different directions that maybe people hadn't really pushed it in before, bringing those jazz elements. And now it's like, it's so revered. It must be a beautiful thing to see that generation after generation discovering it, drawing from it, and then feeding off into their own worlds. That must be beautiful to have that in your life.
Absolutely. I mean, when I went from having the M1DC band, which was an avant-garde band before I did Headhunters, to switching and changing course and doing the Headhunters record, which was, whereas the M1DC band was like a spacey, far-out jazz group, you know, and then Headhunters was more earthy kind of music. I knew why I did that, because I had been listening to Sly Stone and to James Brown a lot, even though I was playing this far out music. And I finally decided I want to do some of that too. So I had to really believe in myself and that I needed to satisfy what I wanted to do, and that I had to be kind of, you know, have my own convictions about what my path should be. I was just thinking about one record, right? I wasn't thinking far off into the future, nothing like that. And I didn't know whether the public would like it or not, but I felt like that's what I want to do. And I knew that the you know, what we sometimes impolitely call the jazz police. I didn't expect that the jazz critics would like what was then a new direction with the Headhunters record. And they didn't, right? And they accused me of selling out. They accused me of pandering to the public. And it was none of those things. I knew why I wanted to do it. And it was my record with my name on it. And I was firm in my own conviction about what I wanted to do. And 25 years later, one of those major national critics, I think he's actually from the UK too, was anyway, he's passed away now. Leonard Feather is his name. He was a big jazz critic. He, 25 years later, I saw him at the Newport Jazz Festival and he apologized to me. And he admitted that he was wrong. He said that was a great record. And I was shocked because critics never do that, right? And I mean, I didn't lose friendship with him. I mean, I still treated him. I mean, that's his job. It's his opinion. He has a right to his opinion. But for him to apologize to me, that was really special. I was brave for him to do that, you know. Because of those kinds of experiences, it really firmed up my sense of trying to continually evolve. Not just do the same kind of thing, you know, continue to follow my own heart. And that's what I've tried to do through the rest of my life.
I do want to ask you, I Thought It Was You was a big hit over in the UK. And like, you're a man who likes technology and like the vocoder on that. Now, Kraftwerk used a vocoder, Wendy Carlos. Were you the first man to have a hit with a vocoder track? I think you might be.
I'm not sure. Well, I know I wasn't the first person to record with that. There was a French guy, Henri Salvador.
Okay.
He actually recorded with a vocoder for a record in France.
I think Tomita had used it as well, but I think maybe yours was the first hit. You kicked it off, man.
Yeah, well, that wasn't really a hit record, you know. I mean, it did okay. But of course, you're right. In the UK, it was.
Yeah, exactly, man.
But in other countries, it wasn't. We played I think, Germany, and then we played in France, and nobody had heard any of those songs. They didn't know anything about it, and they were like, I don't know, you know. But when we played in the UK, everybody was singing it, you know, and I was so happy about that, you know, that lifted our spirits. I've been doing one of the songs now, because the technology didn't exist then for me being able to do vocoder and then do the orchestral parts, but now I'm sort of able to do that live.
Just a blend from behind.
When did you first meet Joni Mitchell? Because that seems like a really nice relationship, like a really beautiful kind of thing you guys have got going. When did you first meet her?
Well, there was a record that she did dedicated to Charlie Mingus, who at the time was dying. And he chose her. He asked her to do a record, you know, based off of him and his music. And she agreed to do it. Now, the person that told me about it was Jaco Pastorius, who was playing bass with the group Weather Report, but I think he was doing records with Joni at the time. Anyway, they were working on the record here in Los Angeles at Joni's place, and Jaco called me, and I had not met Joni before that, but Jaco called me and told me, you know, what the situation was, and he said, "The only person missing is you." I said, "Really?" I said, "Well, who else is on this record?" He said, "Wayne Shorter." I said, "I'll be right there. Where is it?" So when I went over to her house, that's where I met Joni. And we've been friends ever since. And one of the greatest thrills in life is to hear Joni Mitchell and Wayne Shorter have a conversation together. They both speak on that same, like, genius plane. And they both intuitively know what each other is gonna say or what each other means. And if you're listening to the conversation, you gotta hold on like you're holding on to the caboose of a really, really fast train, because it's quite a journey to listen to them talk.
Thank you.
I've got to ask you about Rocket, because I've got to ask you about how the world, like, the world must have kind of changed for you after that in a way, because it was such an important record. It spoke to the past, it spoke to the future. Can you remember it coming out and then the world kind of just going, what is this?
Yeah, I never expected, you know, for that record to get the response that it did. I was completely shocked. I guess maybe we all were. Bill Laswell and Michael Beinhorn, who were the producers, and Bill played bass on the record too, and took off like a rocket. You know, Pharrell Williams named his son Rocket.
No way.
Based off of that song. See, the whole hip hop scene was underground more or less at that time. It hadn't quite emerged to be on a pop level.
Yeah.
And there was something about Rocket that, I don't know, it just fit the times. And breakdancing was still new. I mean, all of those things, and it just fit breakdancing so perfectly. As a matter of fact, somebody told me about a breakdancing contest that was happening in New York.
Yeah.
At the time the Rocket came out. And they had 25 people that were entered the contest, right? He said, there weren't that many songs that were chosen by the artists for breakdancing. I said, what do you mean? He said, out of the 25 people, 24 of them chose Rocket. And I said, I'm glad I wasn't there.
the way you've changed from genre to genre and just moved about. It's the beautiful thing about your music. And I know, going right back to the start, you talked about your mother and saying one of the things that she instilled in you was hope.
Right.
And I think that goes throughout your music. And I think, because unless you've got hope, you don't progress and evolve, because you don't think the next thing could be interesting. It's like, you need hope to keep going. It's like, well, I'm going to try this new thing. Is it going to work? I don't know. I've got hope. I've got hope it will.
You're right. Hope is one thing. And the other thing is to believe in yourself.
Yeah.
To believe that you have your own convictions about what it is that you want to present to the audience. And it shouldn't depend on anybody's evaluation but your own. In other words, you don't need validation from somebody else if it's something that you want to present to them. In other words, if you want to move in a certain direction, it's up to you to create that direction that you want to move in. You need to believe in yourself. That's a very important aspect of living. And to be able to stand up for what you believe in. And that's why I'm working with a lot of young people today, because I need their input. I need their input. So the record I've been working on now for several years.
Yeah.
You know, I have people like Kamasi Washington and Terrace Martin is actually the main producer for the record. And Thundercat. One of the other like sub producers that Terrace brought to the scene, his name is Kid. And I think he was 16 or 17 when he started working on my project. So we have many, many generations that are kind of represented on this new record. And it's not going to be like anything else I've done before, whenever it comes out.
We're going to finish this on a track. What track should we play? It can be anything you want. We're going to go out on a song chosen by you.
I just thought of, it just popped into my head, Nefertiti, the Miles Davis recording.
Yeah.
Wayne Shorter's amazing song. Actually, my input turned out to be an important part of it. And it was my idea that I presented to Miles. Because Miles was always telling us, bring our tunes to the recording session. That's what Miles did. He listened, you know, and he made things work, which is why I respect him so much as a leader. I came up with this idea. I said, well, it's been typical in jazz recordings that the horn players, after we play the melody, the horn players play their solo afterwards, one after one. And then eventually there's piano solo followed by a bass solo sometimes and followed by a drum solo sometimes. By the way, when the horn players are playing, the piano, bass, and drums are playing in the background. I said, why don't we do it different? Why don't we have the horns do the accompaniment and have the rhythm section solo? And Miles said, let's do it. He agreed to it. So, I mean, that was the spirit of it. The way it came out was really, really unique because it really required everybody to kind of reach, make it into something. Anyway, that was one of the reasons I chose that.
Then that's the song we'll finish on. Thank you so much. And we're going to see you at Glastonbury, man.
All right.
I mean, that's going to be, I don't know if you've ever been to Glastonbury before. It's
Yeah, I know. It's huge.
It's going to blow your mind. Everyone is so passionate about all the acts playing. The music is just all day, all night.
I have to remember to bring my wellies.
Yeah. You will have the best time, I promise you. It's going to be something pretty special.
I'm looking forward to it.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Was the title track from Miles Davis's 1968 album Nefertiti, the final choice of my guest on the first time this week, Herbie Hancock. If you head to the BBC Sounds app, you can catch up with older episodes of the first time from the archive, including episodes with Tom York, Janelle Monáe, Dave Grohl and Liam Gallagher. And as you heard, it's Glastonbury next week, so we're taking a break, but Herbie Hancock is playing Glastonbury 2 p.m. on the Pyramid Stage on Sunday, so you'll be able to listen to that on BBC platforms everywhere. But I'll be back in a couple of Sundays, and my guest will be Afrobeat pioneer Shaun Kuti. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.